Kimberly Dozier is CBS News foreign correspondent. Her book is Breathing the Fire, and we had her on during the initial book tour. That's when they put her in a, I don't know, some soundproof room, and they say, okay, here you have 38 seconds to do this next thing, and then hurry up, move on to the next station. And we had, I don't know, 90 seconds with you or something. And I see,
97,
get,
I think,
it was,
yeah.
But it was quality time, wasn't it?
Indeed. I enjoyed every millisecond.
And I begged to get you back on because, for one thing, I hadn't read the whole book yet because the publishing distribution thing was a little out of sync. In fact, I actually went out to bookstores and couldn't find it. It was the publishing date wasn't out there yet. It's there now.
Yeah, and apparently in a lot of bookstores it's sold out. So you've got to go to Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com to find it. And I mean,
obviously,
I'm
it's
happy
sold
to
out,
hear that, but I'm a little ticked off.
But it's sold out because of our 97 seconds we had with you a couple of weeks ago.
Exactly, exactly.
So now I have this. I actually have two copies. I'm sharing one with a friend because it is a terrific book, which I knew when I'd read some excerpts and we talked initially about this, but now having had a chance to savor every moment of this. I mean, it really is, to use the old shop-worn phrase, I laughed, I cried, it became a part of me. It's so
wow.
Moving, and there are moments of humor, of all this real life, the behind-the-scenes, the adventures, just the whole issue of how it plays out when you're doing what you do for a major network, and little tidbits like you hadn't really lived in the U.S. for, what, 14 years?
Yeah, everyone, when I was on that stretcher coming back from Launchtool, they're all like, welcome home, and I'm like, I'm leaving home? What are you all talking about?
Oh, man, surreal moments, and just these segments where you go to other players, if you will, in your recovery after you were nearly killed, and other members of your crew, of course, were in that Memorial Day 2006 IED incident, but you have to go and piece some of the story together with people who said, all right, Kimberly, here's what you were doing. Here's what happened. There are other things you remember really well, including a horrible thing with the guy who fell on you when you're being transported. I mean, it's like one thing after another. You're in excruciating pain. And even with
the poor x-ray technicians, they'd worked an 18-hour shift.
Man.
Like most people I ran across, Bethesda Naval Hospital, Launchtool, everywhere. It was a bad time for the U.S. military. We were getting hit in Iraq and Afghanistan over and over, so the wards were full to the brim. Everyone was pulling extra long shifts, working through their days off, and they were exhausted. And some poor x-ray technician, here I had two shattered legs, and he was reaching across me. The bed collapsed. He fell full on one of my legs. And that's when they discovered I really still had some volume in me. Yeah.
Yeah. And when you're going out to do that story, it's fascinating to get the whole context and feel like you're there with a correspondent embedded, if you will, and just the what goes on living in the beautiful hotel experience there, where you're essentially kind of, you know, taped into the building and always looking at things like, okay, if the building across the street explodes, that's not good because we'll get some of that.
Yes, living in the red zone. What I tried to do in the book was just make you all feel like you're there, and just it was embarrassing. I've talked about it at like bleeding on paper because I try to tell you as how painful parts of it were, but also what it was like to work in Baghdad in the red zone, trapped in a hotel that we had to make into a mini fortress because people's compounds kept getting overrun. And then we'd get rocketed from the outside. Our hotel got rocketed a few times. Eventually, we had to move hotels after I'd been hit because a suicide bomber blew himself up in the lobby. I mean, that's the kind of stuff that you're always making a calculation. Do I go out and do the story? You can't stay too long in the parking lot of your hotel because you know that spotters are watching the parking lot, and if you give them 15 minutes to prepare, they might hit you on the way out.
Yeah, and the other thing is you have these glimpses of what was going on there where they'd have security at that hotel, and they weren't exactly consistent. When you were watching, they go, oh, we're on it, and all these cars parked out in front, that it was the way it always was, and not exactly meticulous examinations of what might be there packed with explosives.
The first hotel that we stayed in when I was still early on having trouble with hypervigilance and all some of the forms of combat stress that can later lead to PTSD, I identified my combat stress problems early on, and so did a lot of other people in our building. We were people were having trouble sleeping because we all knew that we kept going to small hotels that were where foreigners stayed that were getting hit by car bombs. And then we go back to our hotel after standing literally in the wreckage and sometimes the remains of people. You come back to your hotel and see that your guards were not really checking the cars, and they were letting cars park right beneath our windows. And then you try to go to sleep with that in your head, and I picture glass shards heading for my face.
So with all of that going on, that's the environment, that's the backdrop. You're there doing what you sign up to do. You're covering the war for CBS. You've been out in a lot of scary places over the years. And so it's hard to believe, but there actually are moments where you, I don't want to say you get complacent, but the day that the bomb blast occurred, that horrible day, Memorial Day 2006, I mean, you even write about taking your earplugs out and all this. And having been over there in a couple of convoys myself, I know.
Aren't you freaked out in convoys?
Well, yeah, you start thinking about all this, especially when I told my wife, oh, no, we're not going to be in convoys. It'll be fine. And then she went back, she's going through the pictures saying, excuse me, what is this?
You know? Yeah.
But you start thinking, all right, I've got the best and the brightest here. They're covering everything, and they're looking out for my safety as well. And there are moments where you think, that's okay. And then it's not okay.
Well, generally, when I was driving around in convoys, I always thought of roadside bombs. Convoys were a magnet for roadside bombs. We see them leaving their bases in the morning from our tall hotel, which kind of overlooked the city, and then you'd hear explosions, and you'd wonder which one got hit. So every time I was in a convoy or in a Humvee, I didn't even want to put my legs down into the wheel well, because you're like, well, if my legs are down there and the bomb goes off, will they get blown off? And so when we parked on this shoot on Memorial Day and got out, we were walking up and down the street. It was a kind of a deserted street, dusty, boring, in the Corrada, which is quote-unquote the safest place in Baghdad, or so it was at the time.
But not long before you were there.
A small roadside bomb had gone off on that street the day before, and the captain we were following, James Alex Funkhauser, said, shouldn't have gone off there. That means someone's moved into the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. I want to talk to the locals and find out what insurgent cell has moved in.
Now, that's where it kind of goes into slow motion in the book there, because you see members of the military moving. They've obviously spotted a car. They've got some concern about it.
And they didn't like how a few of the cars were parked.
Yeah, how they're parked out there. And you're just kind of taking note of this, and all of a sudden, what happened?
Well, we were, in the meanwhile, while Staff Sergeant Nathan Reed was taking care of the cars, and his nerves were jangling so much, he had them re-park our Humvees several times because he was expecting an attack from the outside. So, and he had his guys checking the parked cars, but Captain Funkhauser was like, okay, eye on the job, looking at the mission, and he needed to talk to the Iraqis on that street. So he let the sergeant do his job, and he was striding down the street away from me after just telling me, you know, we think the insurgents have moved into this area and they could be watching us right now. He walked towards a tea stand where a bunch of Iraqis were standing. And the insurgents were watching us. They were in a hideout in an apartment building a few floors above us, overlooking the area. They triggered a 500-pound car bomb that we were all within 20 feet of at that point with a cell phone. And it just... Some of the soldiers from an Iowa National Guard patrol who heard it ran into the scene afterwards. They said it looked like, you know, the bomb had gone off in the center and all of us were like hands on a clock, radiating outward, flattened away from it when they ran in.
And at that point, you were still conscious enough to be...
I was knocked. I was knocked flat. I was knocked into blackness. I couldn't move. I felt like I was floating in space. When I finally came to and could feel my body, I mean, not that I think I ever lost consciousness, but I could only see the top of my flak jacket as I lifted my head, and I could see burning cars. Now, the car bomb itself was obliterated. They later figured out it was a car bomb when they found engine parts blown into a large crater around which the other cars were smoking. And a Humvee parked near the car bomb had caught fire. A lot of people think we were actually in a Humvee when we got hit because they saw this one picture of this burning Humvee. Mm-hmm. That the Humvee got tossed like a child's toy 4 or 5 feet, and the soldiers on the other side of it got pretty badly injured. But, you know, with that, poor medic Izzy Flores, this is his first mass casualty scene, and he starts running around doing triage. Luckily, he hadn't been hit. He'd been way up the street and inside another Humvee, so he starts running down. Oh, actually, no, he was outside, and he got knocked to the ground. But he starts doing triage, and he said to me, you know, talk to me. Show me you can talk. And because I spoke, and even as I spoke, I knew what I was doing was making sure I would get help later. The ABCs of triage, airway, breathing, and circulation, if you speak, You've proven you've got airway and breathing. Mm-hmm. The medic has to go to the people who are not making any noise to see if he can clear their airway mm-hmm. or restart their heart. And so a staff sergeant from the Iowa National Guard ran into the scene later. First, one of his sergeants pulled me away from the bomb and then immediately went to Paul's side, Paul Douglas, my cameraman. James Brolin, our sound man, couldn't be helped. He'd been killed instantly. And Staff Sergeant Koch came in from the Iowa guy, knelt over me, and he said I was the last person waiting for medical aid, tied the tourniquets on me, and stayed with me, kept me talking, he says, for up to an hour. I only remember 10 minutes.
And this is at a time when you'd lost half your blood or were losing half your blood at the bomb scene.
Exactly. I had shrapnel to the head. My femoral artery was nicked. I had burns from my hips to my ankles.
Your
legs
were a mess, and you thank God you couldn't see them because that would have been a bad thing. That wouldn't have exactly encouraged you. And they're also trying to encourage you as you're wondering about your crew.
Yeah,
they're telling you, well, that you know, they're fine.
They're
because
fine.
They don't want you to get into depression over that, mm-hmm. as things were. There's also one of the captions in the book and the picture of the scene. We're talking with Kimberly Dozier, by the way. Her new book is Breathing the Fire, where there's a note about the bomb scene and what's left of the Humvee closest to the car bomb, etc. And then this struck me. Once the wounded were rushed to the combat hospital, troops stood guard over the dead for several hours. Now, keep in mind that the bad guys in these situations love to have follow-ups if they can. And it's a very dangerous situation, but the respect for those who lost everything and just that idea that they're standing guard over the deceased for hours while they investigate the scene, and you never know what other threats are out there.
Absolutely. Well, it was their captain. The much of the unit that came and stood guard, they'd been back at base while half their patrol was out on duty, and so they rushed in, and they weren't going to leave his side. And Lacey Presley, one of the Iowa team, a medic, she stayed for 3 hours out there, didn't have to. She's back in Baghdad right now, and she and I go back and forth over MySpace, which is, you know, one of the troops' favorite way of communicating. And, you know, she's the hard part for her, for all of those guys, is going out every day with that memory of that day in their heads, knowing it could happen again. And she worries every time she takes her people out. She's like, so far I've brought them all back alive. But, I mean, that's how responsible they feel.
And you've been very, very specific in the book, Kimberly, about making sure that those who gave the ultimate sacrifice are honored. And you have great stuff in there about your whole family, the Dozier family, your dad, a World War II veteran. I mean, just very touching kind of subtext here to the main story throughout this book. But it shouldn't also take away, you have an account in here, but you don't toot your own horn about this, that Sergeant Mapes and something that the sergeant did for you because of making through this is very, very moving. Talk about that a little bit.
Staff Sergeant Steve Mapes, and he is just finishing up his tour of Iraq, third tour. He and his wife Elizabeth were based in Germany at the time I got hit, and I had done a story on him because he'd gotten a Purple Heart when he got wounded in his first tour in Iraq. So he and Elizabeth drove across Germany to get to Landstuhl, you know, an hour and a half drive from their base, to give my family Stephen's Purple Heart. And it was just heart-wrenching. And when he didn't want to see me because he'd been wounded before, he knew I would be on all sorts of drugs. And so he talked to my family, and he gave the Purple Heart to my brother. My brother handed it to me. And, of course, I instantly remembered Sergeant Mapes, his guys loved him. Mm-hmm. And I said, all right, Dad, bring Dad to me. My dad was lightly injured at Iwo Jima, and he would not let himself get put in for a medal because they lost almost everyone in their platoon, something like 70 guys. Mm-hmm. When he walked into my hospital room, I said, Dad, you know that Purple Heart you should have applied for all those years ago? Here. And I opened it up, you know, put it in his hand. And that's the closest I've ever seen him to tearing up.
Mm.
And he's got it still.
Well, so many great stories in this book, and so happy you made it through. Obviously, we feel like it happened yesterday for those who were lost in this. But I tell you, there is no better book. I don't think, and I've read a ton of this stuff. There's no better book out there right now that really captures so many levels of what's going on in this, why we fight the bad guys, what's going on medically. It's huge what's happening. And even though you had, like you point out, there's CBS would come through with at least covering some expenses and things. The whole point is that we have a medical corps out on the field that is unsurpassed. You talk about the greatest generation, and we can debate, as people do, this generation in uniform versus World War II and so forth, but there's no better medical generation is out there right now. I mean,
absolutely,
as evidenced by your story.
Saved my legs, saved my life. They're the reason I'm here talking today.
What moved you most on a spiritual level through this? Because I can only imagine, and you've written about some of that here, but as you look at this, you wake up every day, and I know you wrote a lot about just driving through neighborhoods that were entirely safe after this, where you get spooked and you think back and you start, you know, getting paranoid about what could happen and where people could put bombs. But as you wrestle with this,
that was one of my sergeants who thinks that a lot.
But those recurring kind of nightmares. I mean, every day you got to think, all right, I'm really blessed, and why me to an extent?
Well, one of the things that I've tried to do with, okay, why me? I can't answer that question, but I got to make this count. I nearly went into the Episcopal clergy when I was much younger, and so now I'm like, all right, if I'm going to have to spread a message, some of the message I've been trying to spread is that, you know, you can get through something like this. And in terms of those nightmares and things like that, you know, soldiers don't talk about that.
Yeah.
I put the nightmares and the mini flashbacks I was having in the hospital behind me, and so with the urging of Army commanders, Marine commanders, medical, military health professionals, I've been talking about the fact that I talked about this, I wrote about this, I got this, I leached a lot of the pain out of it, and I'm not plagued by combat stress or post-traumatic stress disorder. And so that's one of the ways that I've tried to get across to people a positive message of my recovery.
Has your faith been strengthened through this?
Absolutely. I mean, it was always... With my family, always been very active in trying to encourage interfaith cooperation between Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. Mm-hmm. And that has just reinforced. When I woke up in Bethesda, I knew that people were praying for me across the world, and that helped me get through it.
Well, it is a powerful book, and I'm really glad we got you back on to talk more about it. I hope you keep selling out on this thing, because it really speaks on a lot of different levels. It's called Breathing the Fire, Fighting to Report and Survive the War in Iraq. Kimberly Dozier, and soon maybe you get back over there if CBS gives you a little slack.
Fantastic. Great to talk to you.
All right. God bless. Appreciate it.